Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of Troy Noons is an Absolute Podcast. I'm your host, as always, John Casillo, and with me today is Dan Lyons.
Hello, hello, everyone. Happy Northeast Heatwave Week, I guess.
We're getting warmer over here for a change. It's finally feeling like I live in Southern California for the first time in 6 months.
Yeah, I mean, we had basically not had like any kind of real spring weather aside from like some blips, and then it's been... Today was like in the mid-80s, so it was a little cooler, but it's been just muggy and like it was mid-90s for like a couple days, so it's just been kind of gross.
Yeah, I really like temperatures to get that high, especially in New York when the humidity accompanies it.
Yeah, then you just get bad smells and it just, it's a lot.
Right. I'm sure we'll all manage through the summer. I don't want to complain too much. I know you don't either. This is kind of the calm before the storm for those of us who cover college sports. We get a few months of not relaxing necessarily. I think there's a lot of research that goes into the next season, but we do get at least just a little less urgency on writing, which is nice.
Yeah, definitely a decent reprieve for a couple months here before we... although the NBA draft is a pretty... It's one of the like weird little things that pops up in these slow months for college sports.
True, this is kind of like the last benchmark before media days begin in July.
Yeah, I feel like every month has like a little thing between like the end of lacrosse. I guess the NFL draft and lacrosse, and then this, and then media days, and then you eventually like start to actually get football practice.
Yeah. And on that note, we are going to talk about the NBA draft a little bit. I know how this works for Syracuse fans. Half of our fan base hates whoever leaves, unless they left with a national title in hand. So half of our fan base hates Tyler Lydon right now, for reasons unknown. Nonetheless, he should be drafted in the first round. I've honestly seen a lot of dropping of late. I think at one point... You know, last year, Lydon was probably considered like a late lottery pick. Worst case, like early, like late teens. And I feel like now he's looking at somewhere in like the 25 to 30 range. I totally understand why. He seems like he's a four at the pro level. Unfortunately, however, he doesn't really have the size of a four in terms of weight. And if he gains too much weight, he could lose the agility and athleticism that's really been an asset for him. Playing sort of a flex, you know, 4 or 5 spot at the college level. But he also can't play the 3 in the pros because he can't really handle the basketball. So I'm sure that we're not the only ones that have seen that. But Dan, where do you right now at least kind of see Tyler Lydon falling in the draft based on what you've read?
It seems like most people have him in like the 21 to like probably 28 range, but a couple in the second round. Not too many earlier than that, but it does seem like he was, like you said, he had probably like late lottery potential last year if he had left, and he didn't. Obviously, he had, you know, a good season, but didn't really take the step to being like that go-to player, and he, you know, disappeared some games. And then it seemed like maybe right on the combine, his stock was dipping into the second round, but it's kind of rebounded a bit. I think he's worked out well. He shot the ball extremely well, I think, in from what I've seen.
Oh yeah, very from everything.
One of the better, yeah, from NBA range too. I think the size thing, just watching like the Warriors play, honestly, helps take away some of that because there's so much positionless basketball being played now. He's definitely a stretch four. I think what actually also helps him a lot, which is one of the things that, especially during the Final Four run last year, I don't know how much it's going to translate that he might be able to give you rim protection at the next level as a 6'9" 4 with 3-point shooting. I mean, if you can get a power forward who can hit, you know, 38 to 40% from three, and also play maybe, you know, if you have probably have to bulk up a little bit, but play a really small ball five for short stretches. I mean, Kevin Durant was doing it in the finals, and obviously Lydon ain't no Kevin Durant, but I don't think he had ever done that before at any level, maybe a little bit of Texas. But that's just, I can see more teams going to small ball lineups like that for a couple minutes at a time, and that could his versatility, I think, could help him a lot.
Yeah, I agree. I think that was always what was attracting people to him last year, and I feel like, oddly, like despite him displaying a lot of the same versatility as a sophomore, it just seemed like everybody was kind of falling off because, like you said, he didn't really jump off. He didn't take that like leap to be a dominant scorer, to be a dominant ball handler, to be someone who could create his own shot, which I think is going to be the biggest kind of black mark on Lydon's resume. But like you said too, he stands a really good chance to make it as a stretch four. The teams that it seems like people are projecting him to, teams like Utah, San Antonio, Portland. In some ways, I think that a younger team like Utah or maybe Portland could be really beneficial to him. I think he'd actually learn a lot with the Spurs and a team that seems like they are obviously system-driven, they're veteran-driven, but also are focused on developing talent. All those things are huge for someone like him that still needs to round out into exactly what he's going to be in the NBA versus, you know, a lot of other players are going to be coming into the NBA is fairly known quantities. I feel like he's going to be the type of project where, like, a small market, again, like the three teams we just mentioned, could actually, you know, invest a bit more and a bit more intelligently in him. I know I've made some comparisons on him for Ryan Anderson. I know Nikola Mirotic is another one on the Bulls, who some may compare him to. I mean, if Lydon can bulk up a little bit and figure out a way to draw more contact, like, the guy shoots almost 84% from the free throw line. He's the type of player who can really, really make an impact with some small things in his game, and he doesn't necessarily need to play 35 minutes to do that. He can probably make an impact in on, you know, 20 to 25 minutes, granted, if it's in the right situation.
Right, and I think that might be one of the things, like, obviously at Syracuse, we would have liked to see him be more aggressive because he was such a passive player at times, especially even when, you know, he was playing well. At the NBA level, I don't know if that's going to be a huge issue. I think maybe they would have liked to see more out of him as a prospect, but the fact that he's not going to be a ball-dominant player, the fact that he can fill a role really well, might actually help, teams feel some positive, you know, teams take that positively, I think, in certain ways. And I also like the teams that he seems to be projected to. I think he fits in well with a lot of them. You mentioned the Jazz, who are a young team who have obviously, Rudy Gobert, and some just a really young roster that did some nice things this year. Not quite as interesting a roster if they end up losing Gordon Hayward, which seems more and more likely by the day, but still pretty intriguing one.
To be honest, I don't know how. I think Hayward's a great player. I don't know how much worse off the Jazz are without him, just because I saw them play a few games last year, even one live without him. And it wasn't the, like, it was, I mean, obviously they're better with him, but it wasn't the worst thing in the world. And I feel like if they add some pieces through the draft, they might actually be able to find that they're not really any worse off.
Yeah, I mean, I think they'll take a hit. I don't think they'll become, like, one of the worst teams in the league, but I don't think they would have been, you know, the team they were this year. I also don't think you can bank on Joe Johnson playing like he did in the playoffs for them next year. But they're an interesting team overall, and they're a pretty well-managed one. Some of the other teams, I think Fox Sports had them going to the Thunder, which would be interesting because they have a lot of frontcourt players, but I don't know if they have a true stretch four like him. And also Syracuse fans would have him and Jeremy Grant on the same team, which would be fun. Jeremy made a pretty, I think, a decent impact last year, and Thunder fans seem to like him. People have him going to the Nets at 22, which would be nice for me. And there's a lot of playing time available, and he also, again, that's another team that doesn't really have a player like him. They have Hollis Jefferson at the wing, but he doesn't really shoot at all, and when he does, it's really bad. Plays to defense, Lydon would add something there. The Blazers should be a team that should be improving. He'd get really good guard play around him. He'd probably get a lot of open looks. So I think his skill set is really a good NBA, and if he's willing to be a role player, which I think we all know he will be, for good, for better or worse, I wouldn't be shocked if he was a turned into a nice, like, 20-minute a Deem die by midseason next year if he is in the right system.
Oh, 100%. And, you know, like, we should caveat this right now by saying, like, people also need to look at the D-League as what it is now and versus what it is or what it was a few years back. Like, so that we have, again, the typical Syracuse fan, unfortunately, who will, you know, deride him, call him a bum and all this other crap. When if Lyman, let's say he's drafted by the Nets and he's playing out in Long Island to start the year, like, the D-League is evolving into something that's a very capable and legitimate minor league, and not just, you know, a place for careers to die. It's actually a place for, you know, some young careers to develop and flourish. Like, if he ends up there, just like Malachi ended up there, Michael Benajay was there for an extended amount of time last year, like, if Leiden ends up in the D-League, that won't be the worst thing in the world. It might actually allow him to better find his way. I don't think he'll be in the D-League to start, because I think he's going to be a first-round pick. But, again, if it happens, it happens. And I do think that he'll be better off for it at the end of the day.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's kind of like the minors in baseball at this point. It's not there yet, but that's seems to be more and more how teams are using it. Like, would you rather have your young 20-year-old, as Leiden's 21, playing, you know, every four games for, like, a couple minutes? Or would you rather have him in the D-League, at least contributing? And teams are taking it a little more seriously. Obviously, they've rebranded. It's actually now the G-League. Shout out to Dieter Reed, who took on the branding and made it way cooler, I guess. But it is being used as more of a minor league feeder system versus where, you know, a couple years ago, it's just where players were set to die. So that's, you know, it's definitely not the end of the world. I mean, we've seen a couple Syracuse players bounce back and forth. Obviously, Urenze Anawaku was down there for a long time and ended up playing really well down there and has gotten some good opportunities from it. I'm interested to see what happens with Chris McCullough. He's been down back and forth with the Nets a lot. Like, they send him up and down all the time.
He played really well last year. Was he an all-star in the D-League?
That sounds right. I don't remember off the top of my head for sure.
And then they traded him to Washington, who is not going to use him at all, which is unfortunate.
Yeah. I mean, I'm interested to see where his thing goes separately, but it's definitely not like the career-ending thing like it was a couple years ago. I mean, with Tyler Ennis, he spent a lot of time there, and now he really had a nice end of the season with the Lakers, who need guard play. So teams are using it more like a minor league.
I think even better than a minor league, to be honest, as far like versus baseball. I think that for baseball, at some point, like if you have a first-round pick or whatever, you're just going to kind of shove him in and force him to figure it out. I think with basketball now, because teams are also putting their D-League teams in a place that's like regionally adjacent or in some cases the same market like the Nets, it makes it much easier to have a player quickly called up back and forth and to have them, you know, kind of quickly deal with issues that they may need to, whether it's just, you know, a shooting slump or whatever. Like, and if you have a guy who you know is not going to play more than 2 or 3 minutes a game, or maybe even not at all, barring a blowout, like, the investment in just having him play in the D-League for a bit, while also, and this is why the Players Association is for the growth of the D-League, while also giving out, you know, a 10-day contract or a couple 10-day contracts to a veteran who, you know, you're just kind of adding for depth, you know, in case of emergency break glass situation, like, this seems like a win-win for the league, and it's improving the quality of players all around.
Yeah, I mean, the big question is how it ends up. I mean, if they really start to invest in it and make it feasible in terms of salary and whatnot, how it impacts the college game. I don't know off the top. Like, it's hard to tell because we're seeing more and more guys make the jump as is just to go play internationally, or guys who really don't have much of a hope of getting drafted in the sitsy pits of the draft, making the leap anyway, even with that realization. So I don't know that it'll be such a crazy impact, but it does have a chance to really change things. Although I think that we've seen kind of a shift in the philosophy with the draft age, and I do wonder if those two things will kind of come in conjunction, like a change to either getting rid of the one and done or making more of the baseball model type deal, along with more of an investment in the G League as a true minor league feeder system.
Yeah, it's not a bad idea at all. Just moving on in a little bit of this NBA draft chat, Dan. There are three other players who could potentially be drafted. I don't think any of them are going to, but that doesn't mean they won't get invited as undrafted free agents afterward. Those names being Andrew White III, John Gillen, and Tyler Roberson. I feel like out of all of them, Andrew White is the most likely because of he's a quality shooter. And I think Roberson might actually be second most, if only because of his size and because of those random games where he showed that he could be a very good rebounder when he put his mind to it.
Yeah, I don't see either of, I don't see Gillen or Roberson making it. Roberson just really just never got to that place where he was contributing on a game-by-game basis like that. And while he does rebound well, even that like went tame and fits and stops. Like, it wasn't like he was rebounding at some exceptional level even when he wasn't scoring. Like, those two things seem to come hand in hand a lot.
Right.
And he's just, you know, he sits 7. He's not like you know, if he was 6'9" and had the same ability, maybe. But I just don't think he has a size for it. I wouldn't shock me if White got some serious looks, just because apparently he shot the ball really well in these workouts too. He's played multiple positions. It wouldn't shock me if he was able to touch on as a 3-and-D type guy. I don't know how, you know, his athleticism is going to translate, but last year he really wasn't even taking the ball to the rim that much. He was pretty much a pure spot shooter. I think he had some of the craziest, like, breakdowns of spot shooting versus, like, putting the ball on the floor in the NCAA based on how Syracuse is using him. So, not that teams wouldn't prefer a guy who can do both, but if he can knock down, you know, 40% of his threes and play decent defense on the wing, like, that's a super valuable thing in the NBA right now.
Hi, J.R. Smith.
Hi, like half of every roster.
I know. I just like to cite JR just for kicks.
I mean, who doesn't? JR is great.
He's excellent. I wish he was still in the Knicks. And old joy is gone.
JR wants to steal Carmelo for the Cavs.
At this point,
he was on Instagram dropping likes.
Just go for it. Just help Melo. Just be happy.
I have no idea how that would work. Like, I support Melo going to try to chase a ring. I have no idea how the hypothetical, like, replace Kevin Love for Carmelo thing works.
I think it works pretty well.
During they already have two. It could. I mean, there's definitely a high ceiling there. I just worry because you already have Kyrie, who's incredibly ball dominant, and LeBron, who's pretty, not super ball dominant,
he
but
need the ball
he wants to be, he reasons. Can be. Yeah, I mean, look at the end of the game 5, like, he literally just took the ball, went full ahead of steam of the basket, and scored pretty much at will. The problem was that the Warriors were up big, and it didn't matter. But he doesn't need the bike. He's not a, you know, spot-up shooter, and he's not a guy who's going to... He doesn't really post up that much as like he did in Miami. So it should definitely work. I don't think it's like super obvious. But Carmelo's also a great scorer, so you put him on a team where he's not the... You know, he's what, the third-best player, probably? Then, you know, maybe he fits right in and turns into just a really nasty... guy getting a lot of open looks.
Yeah, who knows? I guess sort of Carmelo adjacent. Beheim's Army unveiled their new uniforms for this summer, and I like them a lot. They are based on the 2003 uniforms that we won when we won the national championship. I wish we still had these uniforms as our full-time ones if we don't have the script ones. Dan, your thoughts? I assume you're on the same page. Great look for them and a nice way to kind of get fans excited.
Yeah, I mean, I think this whole the TB's pure fan service and just getting people excited for, you know, old school players and nostalgia. So there's really no better option than going with jerseys that remind people of the great days. I mean, last year they had the stripped-ish uniforms. They didn't look like totally like the mid-90s strips, but they were definitely like evocative of that. This year's same kind of deal. They have the striping down the side. They have the same font. Obviously, they use Melo's number 15. I like them. I think that's a good jersey. The Syracuse jersey is good. I think the Beheim's Army jersey, which is pretty close to it, is a solid look. I look forward to the next year's, which will have the duct tape striping, and Johnny Flynn will appear out of nowhere to play for the team.
Well, they have... I want to say they changed a little bit around the rules for ringers and all that.
Did they? I haven't really looked into it too much yet this year.
Yeah, I don't think you can add players as late as you did in previous years.
When does that actually tip off? I don't even know what the schedule is.
They have like the Jamboree format for like the play-in games, basically. Then they're going to announce seeding on the 20th, and then the games tip off for the Eastern bracket on the 8th and 9th of July in Philadelphia.
Nice. So we're getting there.
Yeah, we're
between this and the 3-on-3 Ice Cube tournament, it should be a pretty fun summer. I mean, the summer like really needs this kind of stuff, so I'm all for it. I like all of these things, and the TBT, like I expect it to be pretty fun. Like, I think we've all gotten way more into it the last 2 years than we thought we would.
Well, ESPN's also helped there. I mean, the fact that
there's
so many teams now and there's so much demand, and like, I mean, there's like a UConn-ish team. There's a complete Villanova team. There's a Pitt team. There's a Dayton team. There's a bunch of others. I mean, and the fact that like the coaches are getting involved and like promoting it. I mean, for them, it's beneficial. You get to talk about players you coached and players that used to go to your school. It's a recruiting tool in some ways. Like, there's just a lot of. To me, it's just a fun sideshow to college basketball, but a good and necessary one in a sport that, you know, obviously has its own problems and has its own issues with games being, you know, less fun sometimes than maybe they should be.
Yeah, especially with college basketball, like, the season's not that much shorter than other seasons, but it feels shorter because so many other people don't get involved until, like, February. Right. Obviously, those of us who follow the teams, you know, closely are in on it in early November when everything tips off, and even before that as we get to the run-up. But even then, like, there's a pretty substantial break between the first week in April and roughly the first week in November. So having this tournament for like a month and smack in the middle of the summer, I think, is really nice for I mean, now a lot of fan bases, because I think we were one of the first ones that really had a big team 2 years ago. There were a couple other schools that had like similar ones, but now it seems like you said, there are at least like fractions of alumni from like a ton of huge schools, which definitely makes it more fun. Granted, I'm pretty sure both champions have been, like, I think one was, a D-League team that, like, came back to play. It's pretty, and then the other one was, like, a group of international players, like, American-born players from abroad that, like, played internationally. So, we'll see which one of these college teams can finally break through, if that happens this year.
Hopefully it's us.
That'd be nice. Get Devo some money.
So, one more thing before halftime, and then we'll head into Sunbelt discussions. Dan, once again, Syracuse is doing their orange out and their fan design t-shirts. This year, however, the orange out game is on homecoming. I'm not sure why these things are all intersecting. What's your favorite t-shirt design that we proposed?
I'm going through them now. I just laughed at my t-shirts are now scheduled through 2019. Very on brand for the site. We should be the Robins is amazing. I don't even know what to say about Meth Possums. I really enjoyed that you didn't even make the logo like fit in the t-shirt.
Oh, hell no.
Just some really strong painting. There's a lot of. I don't even know what to say about the cancel. Just so long. Don't want to get political on the podcast, John.
No. All in good fun.
I forgot about Method Cat.
I had forgotten until somebody mentioned it like the other day, and I was like, "Shit! Like, how did I forget that?" Like, one of the like banes of my existence for like upwards of.
I mean, Western Michigan needs a new brand thing since Minnesota bought Row the Boat from them. Like, Fleck how is Method...
Fleck is so, like, shrewd. Like, in a good way and also in a bad way. Like, I'm sure you saw that thing he did with the football camp video.
Oh, yeah, amazing. Like, I love that he got reported for that. It's so funny.
Got reported for it and then suffered zero consequences.
Of course, he didn't break any rules. Brilliant. Like, why not? But he's just very smart. He's very Harbaugh. He's a little less like intense, but like Shrek, not Shrek. Oh God, Fleck. PJ Shrek.
Now I'm just imagining like a god awful Scottish accent at a post game.
That's what happens when you spend too much. That's going to be in 3 years after, like, too much exposure to the Big Ten West. That was just brilliant. Like, for those of you who don't know what we're talking about, because it's just total, like, college football minutia, there's a rule loophole where you can... basically, he made a hype video for one of the camps that Minnesota was running, but he used it because of a loophole to basically feature a bunch of big recruits that they're after and prominently showed them in the video. So he technically, like, advertised players he was recruiting, but squeezed it into, like, a different thing, so he was allowed to do it. And it was very shrewd. It was within the rules. I'm sure those rules didn't change, like, tomorrow, because that's how the NCAA works. But the fact that other schools that really worked out about it is just so great. I ride for PJ Fleck forever.
He's a good guy. If I'm getting back to the original topic, I really want the Meth Possum shirt, to be honest. I've actually, and I might as well give this away, I'm putting together like an oral history of the Meth Possums to be released at some point this summer. For those who have not ventured into the comments during the off season, we randomly decided that the original team name of Florida Gulf Coast was the Meth Possums. It has become kind of a running joke. As anyone familiar with the site knows, these things kind of take on a life of their own. So I figured, why not just lean into that during months when we still can? So that will be out at some point soon. I will not be making any sort of time commitment as to when, because schedules change and I don't always know what my week's going to look like.
My favorite part is that it pops up in just some of the most random posts, like recruiting football recruiting posts. I think a lacrosse post, like it hasn't actually, I don't even think it's come up in like a post about Georgetown or something.
No,
it's just, I don't really remember where it originated. But it is wonderful and I appreciate it.
I'm just glad that I found the logo for it so early. And it's just become an accepted part of the allure and the backstory of the majestic Meth Possum.
I mean, Florida, I keep on mixing up very different things. Florida Gulf Coast has shown that it will adopt branding very quickly. So I'm all for this movement. I hope they come into prominence again soon, and then maybe we can just force upon them.
Fine to me. All right, I think it's time for halftime. Dan, what have you been drinking?
A couple of different things. I was tailgating for a concert over the weekend, so I had some good stuff. Finished off my Brooklyn Sriracha Ace, which isn't the most obvious tailgate beer, but I had some of it left, so I wanted to bring it along. And it's not the worst, because it's pretty drinkable for a Saison. I had No Limits Hefeweizen from Two Roads, Connecticut. One of my favorite breweries up there, which I bring up a lot. Their Hefe is quite good. I had some Stolpin, naturally. I think the highlight of my week, my friends brought up, was the Dogfish's Sea Quench Ale, which was kind of, it's not branded as such, but it's more or less like a margarita sour. It is really, really delicious. Super, super drinkable, especially for a really hot day like we had. It's like all aboard on the flavors. It's also a session, which was nice for drinking for like 3 hours outdoors. But it's a really nice blend of things. It has kind of like the goza saltiness, a lot of lime. Apparently they're calling it a Kolsch, which I guess I can see. It's just like a blend of a lot of different things, but I thought it worked really well.
Cool. What did I drink? Had Stone and Maine Beer Company did a collaboration IPL called Day Slayer, and that was actually super good. Had that on draft over at Hop Saint. What else did I have? Went down to the brewery, actually. I had to pick up some things. So I had a couple different beers from them. Had a, it's called Spritz and Umlaut. It's a like German-style like Berliner Weiss, which is kind of interesting. Like Berliner Weiss usually don't associate with like heavier German hops, but this had a nice kind of merging of the two, just kind of styles. Also they had a sour ale called Culture Club Romance Revisited. It was a very good I think it was like a raspberry. There's a couple other things going on. Sorry, I don't have more notes on that one. And also had the cleverly named Taking My Talents to Anaheim, which is a beer that they made with Jay Wakefield down in Miami. So that reference, fairly obvious for those who haven't caught on by now to the decision.
And also every recruiting announcement of the last, like, 18 years.
Exactly. Thanks, LeBron. Then also had the Melange number 9. It was a sour ale wheat wine collab. Well, sour ale wheat wine blend with, I think it was lemon, ginger, and coconut. So yeah, that one's pretty good. Then had during the USA-Mexico soccer game on Sunday, had a couple cans of Pickleweed Point IPA from Pizza Port, as well as a bottle of Alpha Galactic Pale Ale from Beechwood. So yeah, productive-ish drinking weekend.
Yeah, it's going to be, I'm going down to, because I for whatever reason, to not escape the state of South Carolina this year, I'm going down to a bachelor party in Myrtle Beach on Friday, so pray for me, and also I will be drinking down there. I have no idea what the craft beer scene is going to look like. There's a decent chance that it will not end up mattering.
That's fair. I can't blame you on that. Most bachelor parties I go to are either Vegas or San Diego, so San Diego, obviously, we're set on beer. Vegas depends on my mood.
Yeah, I feel like Vegas is not the most beery city.
No, there is that one place, that one bar that I found like the last time or last couple times I was there, over in like the Quad, which is like right over by Caesars and mid part of the Strip. That area, I regret finding the craft beer bar, because when it's hot in Vegas and you're out all day drinking, like, that's really not what you want.
No, I discovered the frozen. Giant frozen drinks that they serve on the side of the street, and that was nice.
Oh, Fat Tuesday? Yeah, I remember.
Maybe. I don't know. It was like 4 a.m.
The first, like, 3 times I was there, I pretty much just, like, filled up Fat Tuesday, got the extra shot every single time, and then, you know, spent the day with a permabuzz, which was my younger years. I don't think I can do that anymore.
Yeah. That was pretty much like a haze. I will be back there in August, so we will get right back to it.
Okay, so hopefully everyone's still here. We're going to be talking about the Sun Belt today. Now, we talked about the Sun Belt a little bit last week, but today we're going to try to keep it as Sun Belt-y as possible and keep Conference USA out of it. Sun Belt's actually interesting for those who don't spend as much time as Dan and I do watching some of these lesser games, both during the week and on the weekend. Be surprised what ends up coming across your screen in terms of just really entertaining football. I think we should start with Appalachian State. We're not going to go through everybody, but I think Appalachian State is one of the more interesting programs in the country. Obviously, they're in the middle of nowhere, Boone, North Carolina. They are, by name, of course, in the Appalachian Mountains. They had a great culture at the FCS level and had managed to not only translate that to FBS success, Dan, but somehow actually have gotten better in the last few years, and if that makes any sense.
Yeah, it's actually, I don't know if it should be surprising, but it seems like there's a pretty high, like, conversion rate for these, like, really good FCS teams making the jump. Am I, like, crazy, or that does seem to be happening?
You're actually dead on. I did an article about this on the comeback a few weeks ago. And
okay, cool.
Yeah, I did it about Coastal Carolina, and kind of like used them as
right because they're
the newest one. Yeah, and the only teams like screw this up are UMass and I mean, like, South Alabama's never really pulled it off too well.
Yeah, I mean, South Alabama has been great, but even they've had like moments. Yeah. They just haven't had like the real success. And I don't was South Alabama like a power at the FCS level? I don't totally remember.
Yeah, I mean, I think they formed the. They, like, formed, they were, them, Texas State, a couple others, like, formed their program. Or no, not yeah, Texas State. Them, UTSA, and, like, somebody else, like, recently formed their program, like, just for jumping up. Well, Georgia State did the same thing. They formed their program.
Georgia State kind of did that, yeah.
Yeah, so, like, a bunch of them have, like, I mean, you take a perfect formula, and then that's kind of why the Sun Belt's been successful. You take FCS programs who have a history of success, fan support. They have a local recruiting ground that people are familiar with. You add in programs in fertile recruiting area, Georgia State's in Atlanta. They have Georgia Southern's also in Georgia. You got Appalachian State, while they're not in the like center area where there's a ton of talent, they're pre-established, and on top of that are in North Carolina where there is just a ton of talent in general. UTSA is in Conference USA. Who else is in the Sun Belt? Well, Coastal Carolina is coming in, and they're another program that only started up in the last decade, but South Carolina is a pretty fertile recruiting area.
Troy, obviously, down in Alabama.
Yeah, Troy down in Alabama, and they've, I mean, done a great job over the past 20 years, like, having pretty consistent success outside of, like, a small valley in there. Who else is in that league?
Lafayette and Monroe, one of whom has been quite consistent, and one of whom is not.
Even Lafayette lately, though, is not really, like, they haven't been world beaters, necessarily.
No, they've dipped a little bit recently. But, I mean, I think they're usually, like, at least a decent bowl bet. Right. Monroe has, like, beaten Alabama and also been really terrible. So.
Who else? I mean, Texas State's in a great area, even if they haven't really put it together yet. I think UTSA is probably a little bit better situated than them. New Mexico State and Idaho are gone. I think we can talk about them later. Arkansas State's another program. I think Arkansas State and then the Georgia schools are probably all, like, if Conference USA ever felt like they need to expand again, I feel like they'd eye Arkansas State and Appalachian State, but I don't know if they'd come along.
Yeah, it's tough because I don't know that it's, like, super obvious that Conference USA is a step up. Like, obviously, I think Bill C had Sun Belt ahead of him last year, right?
Yeah, they, I think, fell, like, slightly.
Which, obviously, that's not what it means, but it has to do with more, you know, TV stuff. But I feel like the Sun Belt is, like, slightly better, like, slightly more coherent. I think we talked about this last week. Slightly better branded.
TV-wise,
it's more,
they're even, like, I mean, at this point, Sun Belt has a deal with ESPN, and Conference USA doesn't even have that anymore, really.
Right. The Sun Belt really, it seemed like, aimed to try to be the Southern MAC. Just kind of, like, know who it is. Obviously, it's a little more volatile because the MAC kind of holds together pretty well. But, like, they have more... the FCS thing, I think, is a nice model because you build up fan support and identity. Like, talking about Georgia Southern, like, that's a historic program. They have super, like, high levels of tradition, and they sell out, and they, like, have a whole, like, offensive identity that they stick to religiously. Like, that's a football program that if you... like, are in the weeds of college football a little bit, like, you know what you're getting out of Georgia Southern, and most of these group of five programs that, you know, are in, like, the Sun Belt level, like, you don't, you, if you're not a diehard, like, you don't know what their, like, their team looks like on a day-to-day basis, but with the Sun Belt, you have, like, some of those. Obviously, Appalachian State has a super signature win when they were in FCS and beat Michigan at the Big House. Arkansas State's played a pretty fun running, had this pretty good running attack for a couple of years. Southern has their option. So you have, like, an idea of who these teams are versus even compared to, like, Conference USA, where it's a little more of a mishmashed league.
Yeah, agreed. And, like, just using this as a little bit of a segue, like, Troy might not even win the league this year. Like, Troy was dangerously close to, like, a real conversation around the Access Bowl bid last year. Like, they barely lost to Clemson, and some might actually argue they should have beaten Clemson based on what was a bad call. They didn't necessarily keep it together for the full conference season, but, you know, Troy won. I think they went 10-3 last year. Like, they
were sniffing around the top 25, weren't they?
Yeah, they were sniffing around the top 25 at one point. Like, they're definitely, they have an offense and, like, a really, really good one. I mean, their quarterback, Brandon Silvers, who's back this year, will be there. Like, Troy is a lot, and I wrote about them last year too, actually. They're just a fun program. Like, they used to be fun. I remember when we were kids, like, Troy was, like, starting to pull things together in what was then, like, a different Sun Belt. North Texas was a power for a while. Middle Tennessee was a power for a bit, but, like, Troy strung together a bunch of seasons in a row Well, they were pretty good. Neil Brown has just become like an electrifying like presence down there, and like he's a guy who's under 40, doesn't have any like super obvious ties to any other jobs either. Like he played for Kentucky at the beginning of his collegiate career, and then moved on to UMass. So it's not as if he's like kind of pigeonholed into an area. I mean, maybe Kentucky, but yeah, I think, you know, Neil Brown is a guy who's a rising name. Again, maybe there's some draw to places like Kentucky and Texas Tech where he's worked before, but largely, like, he's done a really impressive job in a short amount of time at Troy, and he's probably leaving if they're successful once again this year. But it shouldn't be discounted that Troy is probably one of the best situated teams just because of the, you know, rabid fan base down there in Alabama. Obviously, again, like we said, the Georgia schools are well situated, and then App State, well situated just because of its long-standing tradition down there, similar to Georgia Southern's. I think Arkansas State, to me, is probably the most interesting program because, you know, Arkansas, while it does recruit well, it doesn't really have the same large presence of great players. Arkansas doesn't necessarily have the huge hubs of talent that some of the other Southern states do. You know, Arkansas Razorbacks struggle enough to be like a consistent top 25, 30 recruiting program. So Ark State's not necessarily going to bank on, you know, picking up like a ton of local kids. They also turn over their coach every year. I know last week we talked about, you know, Western Kentucky kind of being an interesting case of like how a program can lean into a reputation as like a proving ground for coaches and just, you know, continually hit on quality hires. Like Ark State is another case of that, where they've managed to like pulling up their like list of coaches now, but Ark State has managed to, for the most part, like after a rough start to their tenure in FBS ball, I feel like they've actually done a fantastic job in the last probably 7 to 10 years.
Yeah, I mean, they're one of those teams that you can like turn on a college football game on like a Tuesday night, and if Arkansas State's playing, like, it's probably going to be a pretty fun game, and especially early in the year, I feel like they often put stares into people over the last couple of years. Going back to Troy, like, Neil Brown, like you said, he's just not one for that program, because that dude is one of the rising star coaches. I'm surprised he has actually gotten more attention. I know he's only been a head coach for 2 years, and they took him from 4-8 to 10-3, but after last year, I mean, I think this year is it, unless they like fall on their face for him at Troy.
Obviously, there's no luck. Senior quarterback and everything else, like they seem well situated.
I'd be very surprised. Yeah, it wouldn't shock me. Like you brought up Texas Tech, if they wanted to move up from Kingsbury, which it seems like they're kind of loath to do, but it has to happen eventually. If he doesn't get it around, turn it around, that could be a place. But Brown's definitely got to be one of the hotter coaching commodities, I think, heading into next year's coaching carousel. Blake Anderson at Arkansas State, 24-15 in 4 years, like that's pretty good, or 3 years, I think. A little older, he's 48, but he's not like super old, but like, he can go take over a bigger program if he wants. But he's just done, I mean, he's been really good through 3 years, 7-6, 9-4, 8-5. I do wonder if he's also going to be a guy that gets some looks.
I mean, probably, you look at the reputation this place has been able to build. I mean, three former Arkansas State coaches are at very big jobs right now. Hugh Freeze, obviously, at Ole Miss. You have Gus Malzahn, who's over at Auburn, and then you have Brian Harrison, who's over at Boise State. You know, Anderson, not necessarily the same mold of coach as those guys. Those were guys who were going to Ark State to kind of stay in a footprint. Well, the first two, stay in a footprint before getting an SEC job. For Harsin, it was to just head somewhere else until Chris Peterson got done with being a Boise, and then he headed right back to Boise. I think that, you know, Anderson's a different mold of coach, but nonetheless, you know, Ark State kind of proving once again to be a very interesting and capable recruiting area, yes, but more than that, a proving ground for coaches who want to be able to, you know, kind of gnash teeth a little bit and really kind of warm up for what could be a bigger job. And again, like we said with Western Kentucky last week, if your program can figure out how to do that and your fan base can be conditioned to accept it, you could potentially have a lot of success. I know right now, you know, we're hoping that that's not the case for Syracuse and Dino Babers' long-term relationship. But if for some reason, you know, if Babers gets to 7-5 or 8-4 and the bigger offers come coming this summer, well, next summer or next fall, well, no, next winter, sorry.
That might it's be Syracuse, just say winter, it's probably right.
That's fair. Yeah, that might be something worth, and if Sean mentioned this, you know, when we fired Scott Schaefer, and I know you and I are probably on the same boat, like, Syracuse, this is a model that you could potentially, I mean, no, we're not in the same fertile recruiting ground as some of these Sun Belt programs and things like that, but potentially trying to get more accustomed to change and rotation and accepting the fact that a guy was going to come in, use Syracuse as a stepping stone, because let's be honest, it is a stepping stone job in the terms of the Power Five. And, you know, if you manage to hit on two out of every three hires, like, as long as the one that doesn't hit is not a disaster, and that depends on what your definition of Scott Schaefer is, really, you can survive as a program pretty well and make a bowl game 4 out of every 6 years.
Yeah, that's a pretty realistic, good model. I was going to say Ole Miss, definitely one of those schools that could be looking at Neil Brown next year.
Yeah, that sounds right, unless they get hit with, like, a pretty big penalty, which rumors around the internet say that they very well might. I'm very interested to see what happens with Hugh Freeze. Honestly, like, the SEC West, and we're not going to talk about SEC this week, but the SEC West has a lot of intrigue and usually a lot of turnover just because of what they're up against over there. I mean, at the end of the day, it depends on which fan base and which athletic department and which boosters are okay with finishing behind Alabama. And those that aren't, fire their coach, and those that are, keep their coach around sometimes too long. I think that Dan Mullen's stuck at Mississippi State now, and I think Mississippi State stuck with him. I think Ole Miss and Auburn could both be potentially changing coaches. A&M, I think, is a prime candidate for a coaching change. I think someone's done a nice job, but I think there's been a ceiling with someone that the right coach could probably turn A&M into what we thought they were going to be when the Manziel era started. And then Arkansas, I don't know. I think Arkansas might have the most realistic fan base, surprisingly, Arkansas and Mississippi State probably had the most realistic fan bases out of all the SEC West schools, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I think it might be because Arkansas isn't like a dyed-in-the-wool SEC school, and Mississippi State just is what it is. It wouldn't shock me if Hugh Freeze got fired, especially considering what, like, some of the bubbling word in the street is about what those penalties look like. I think we talked about this in the last couple of weeks. Like, there's, like, probably the most digestible NCAA scandal for the organization versus, like, what's going on at Louisville or, obviously, North Carolina. So it wouldn't shock me if they got, like, by far the worst penalty, just because it's the most close to what you expect an NCAA scandal to be. That being said, they also have the coach who has had the most success against Nick Saban head-to-head, with two wins in a row, and then, like, honestly almost beat them last year with a team that ended up falling on its face. So it also wouldn't shock me, because the SEC is the SEC, if Hugh Freeze got fired and then probably had to spend, like, a year away and then just got hired by, like, another one of those teams again. Like, if Butch Jones got fired at Tennessee, which is definitely in play because he's underachieved, and Hugh Freeze got fired this year, how... and let's say Tennessee couldn't land someone huge. Would it shock anyone if Butch was, or if Freeze was the Tennessee head coach, like, 2 years later? No.
As long as he didn't get a show cause, no. Because the SEC has no
idea. He didn't get a show cause.
Right. The SEC has no idea how to hire outside of its, like, tree. And I know other podcasts and other articles have talked about this, and that's why the SEC is in shambles right now outside of Alabama, because no one understands that you can't beat Saban with Saban, and you can't... There are other options around college football, and that's why the SEC is slowly but surely, like, kind of falling down to be one of the less entertaining like watches on a weekendly basis, and that's going to have an impact over a long period of time.
Yeah, they all try to get their own Saban when, if they want to beat Saban, they need to think outside the box. I mean, it's not that hard. You look at the schools that have beaten Alabama recently. Clemson, obviously very different than Alabama stylistically. A&M, Ole Miss, Oklahoma a couple years ago. Like, all up-tempo, spread them out. Like, all very kind of similar schools with big-time quarterbacks who can run and throw. Like, there is a model there. Obviously, you're not going to beat them every year, but going and hiring all of Saban's assistants to run Alabama systems and see if, you know, you're going to out-Bama them, that's just, it's dumb. But that's a discussion for, I mean, that'll probably be like the whole discussion SEC week.
100%. Speaking of Alabama assistants, though, looking at Appalachian State's schedule, you know who they face in week one?
I don't remember off the top of my head.
Georgia.
Ooh.
Now, if Kirby Smart finds a way to get fired in year two,
that's one way to do it.
It includes this game. Actually, I think if he loses that game, he might just get fired by game two of year two. Yeah, App State could very well go 10-2, 11-1 versus this schedule. Georgia and Wake Forest are really the biggest tests on there. They avoid Troy. They avoid Arkansas State in the Sun Belt. Really, like, you're looking at a pretty manageable schedule here.
You have Georgia Southern at home.
Yeah, you get Georgia Southern at home. You get Georgia State, which I'm not super worried about. And yeah, you basically got, you've got a Wake Forest game at home. Again, Wake's pretty close by. You've got the Georgia game on the road, and you look at the rest of the schedule, like at UMass, at Funroe, at Georgia State. Like, none of these games are going to scare you. So, App State's, I think, 10-2 is like their floor this year, which is, again, insane to talk about a still recently new to FBS program in those kind of terms. But it's completely true. And on top of that, because of how, to be honest, good the Sun Belt is at the top, like, App State might still be, like, playing until the last week to see if they can win that conference because of how good Troy and Arkansas State are.
Yeah, the App State-Troy, I think those are probably the top two. Arkansas State could jump up there as well. That should be a really fun run to the end here for the Sun Belt title because those two teams, I think, will be probably among the 5 to 10, well, no, that's pretty obvious. Probably fighting for, like, top five in terms of the group of five. Like, they're both quite good.
I would agree. And then I guess to cap us off, Dan, because I did want to talk about more than just a couple schools. Idaho and New Mexico State are leaving after this year. New Mexico State's going to try to tough it out as an independent, which I think is a terrible idea. Idaho is going to join the Big West. The Vandals looked like they were a lot of fun last year. Are you sad to see the Vandals go?
Yeah, I think you're especially a school that's like from an area that doesn't have other FBS football. Like any school like that, I feel like you don't want to lose any of them, but especially one from like that area of the country where you have like a handful of schools and that's it. You don't really want to see people dropping down. Like it stinks, but obviously there are reasons for it. So hopefully it's put together a nice outgoing year here. Before they cede that entire, basically that entire ground to Wyoming and Boise and
sort of already did,
I guess. Well, basically, but they've been like fairly competitive at times. Like,
yeah,
it's just tough. The recruiting grounds aren't there. You have you're fighting with like some of those big FCS powers around there for players. It's just it's not a great situation. But hopefully, everyone there makes the best of it for this last year.
Agreed. And then what do you think about New Mexico State's decision? I think it's bad, again. I mean, I know they're facing Liberty with, like, a home-and-home in 2 years, and I think if that's on your schedule as an independent, it's you don't have the ability to be an independent, in my eyes.
I just don't know what they're going to do.
Right, like, at what point are... Because at this point now, there's too many independents. There's an increase in conference games for the Pac-12, the Big 12, and the Big 10. So now you only have 3 games per year for all those schools, and a lot of them are already scheduled out for the next 10 years.
You can only play UMass so often. Right. We joked about the UMass New Mexico State rivalry, which is going to force itself into existence. But like, I just don't know how it's feasible, especially for that school. Like, people aren't going to want to travel there. How are you going to get more than 5 home games a year? I don't know.
Right. Alas, good luck, Aggies. And then lastly,
I hope they figure it out. Because again, I don't like losing schools, especially ones in like interesting areas and whatnot. But it just doesn't seem to. I don't know how it's going to work. Hopefully, I'm missing something.
Maybe the Mountain West would be nice. Invite them in North Dakota State.
Or North Dakota State could just come in and take the Idaho spot, and I think that'd be interesting. I'm surprised we haven't gotten more buzz about that, like them and Montana and some of those other schools like weighing in, but they could just be happy with what they're doing.
True. All right, I guess lastly, Coastal Carolina. I mentioned them at the beginning. You said I wrote that article probably a few weeks back about Joe Moglia and Coastal Carolina and how they've been able to, in like a very short amount of time, build a bunch of boosters, a bunch of excitement, a pretty full stadium every Saturday, an entire culture. They've got a turquoise field, the whole deal. They're a pretty wacky group there. They were also a new mascot for college football, the Chanticleers. They have a rooster who's not the same rooster as the Gamecocks, which should be leading at some point to some fun and angry Twitter arguments, I'm sure, about which rooster's best. I'll leave it at that. But yeah, I'm very excited for Coastal Carolina to start. I think that putting this program to the test early on could be an interesting gauge about whether or not we see yet another wave after this of new programs and like upstart programs, like a lot of the ones we've talked about already in the last 2 weeks.
Yeah, I mean, as long as you can get former giant bank CEOs to take over your football program, you can definitely make it happen.
Yeah, he's an interesting cat. Yeah, he's not a method.
Definitely one of the best stories.
Oh, one of the best stories. He's not a method cat, though. He's just an interesting cat overall. Yeah. He's got... Yeah, he was... I think it was TD Ameritrade?
Yes, he was the CEO of TD Ameritrade for like 18 years or something.
Yeah.
I think I wrote about him recently somewhere.
Yeah, Warren Buffett's a big fan of him.
Then he just decided he wanted to coach college football, which he had done like in the 80s for Dartmouth. And he... up Bo Pelini and was like, hey, let me come hang out, and then he did, and then he became like an assistant coach, and then he became the head coach at Coastal Carolina, which just, and now, but I appreciate him because he's like super innovative, he is very forward thinking, and look at their schedule, like this is about as good a transitional schedule as you're going to get.
Hold on, let me pull it up.
They're hosting UMass week one, no, then they travel to UAB for week two. And then they host Western Illinois. Very good chance that they're going to open 3-0. And then they go at Arkansas. There might be a game squeezed in there. Then they're at Arkansas in November. I don't know why the schedule doesn't have like the full day. It's deserved. They're in this conference where there are like Tuesday night games and stuff. Arkansas is in November. So that'll be later on. But there's a very good chance that they're picking up at least 3 wins in September when those first 3 non-conference games are. I'm not quite sure what their other September.
No, they might be 5-0. They could go 5-0 to start this season.
Who else do they have squeezed in there?
They got UMass at UAB, Western Illinois at Fun Row, and versus Georgia State.
Yeah, that's really impressive. That's just really good scheduling work, and I hope that whoever does their schedules, Syracuse hires.
Yeah, please do that. But then after that. At Ark State, at Appalachian State, versus Texas State, at Arkansas, versus Troy. So they probably...
That's a brutal finish.
Yeah. If they start 5-0, they're going 5-5. And then they have Idaho on the road and Georgia Southern to end it.
They need to hope they open 5-0. You're probably going to take some lumps. And then you have that Texas State game, which they should win on October 28th to pick up win number 6. No, I mean Texas State's not that good.
Well, Coastal's also still in their first year though.
Right. But
in 2 years when I think Coastal's set to go.
Yeah. I could see them sneak. Well, they can't. Can they go to a bowl this year, or are they probationary or whatever?
I think
yeah, that's a stupid rule anyway.
It is. I don't think they can go to bowl until either next year or the year after.
That's such a dumb rule. There aren't enough bowls. Like, why are you doing this to teams? Either way, I mean, I think that's a good way to get excitement about the program, even if they ended up flaming out in mid-October.
Oh, yeah. If they can win at least... If they can win three games this year, I think that's a really good base to go from there. And hey,
right.
Also on Coastal is a former Syracuse quarterback, Austin Wilson.
Oh, I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Do we have any idea if he's in line to contend to start?
No, I don't think he is. Because they've got that that kid who sounded like he was the lead singer of a 80s hair band or something. What was his name? Slash? Something ridiculous?
I'm looking. They have... I don't see a Slash. I see a...
Some wacky ass... He's got a dope name.
I'll find it. This is important.
Yeah, this is how we're going to end the podcast.
Googling Coastal Carol.
Chance Thrasher.
Oh, that's amazing.
Best name in college football.
It's also weirdly close to Chance the Rapper. It's metal Chance the Rapper.
I really wish they could make t-shirts for individual players and still be within the NCAA rules, because Chance the Thrasher.
My favorite part is that I'm on his profile. Does not look like a Chance Thrasher.
Interesting.
Does not look like he does very much thrashing at all.
I wish he was number 3. And just had just as a joke, wore a 3 hat all the time.
He was a 3-star recruit, though.
Oh, there you go. We'll take it. Anyway, I think that's a good place to stop.
Yes.
Dan, actually, no, before we go, App State or Troy?
That's right.
Troy. I'm going to go with Troy as well. It's going to be tight, though.
It's a coin flip, I think. I liked what Troy was last year. I thought they have I have an infatuation with Neil Brown as a coach. I hope a program that doesn't suck hires him after next year. I just think they returned so much, and they were just really, really good last year. So I just trust them a little more, but it wouldn't shock me if App State's always good. So obviously there's no surprise there.
Agreed. I think the only thing that gets App above them is the schedule. So
yeah,
we shall see. Anyway, Dan, thanks as always for joining. Much appreciated.
Of course.
And everyone be sure to rate, review, subscribe on iTunes, on Blog Talk, on any other service you might use to listen to us on. And go Orange.
Go Orange.